got up this morning and looked around me. Do you see the beauty of my hovering? Took a little walk into the town, laying down sorrow were the things I found.
Bernard always had this quote, dignity is inherent in every human being. It's not something someone gives you. It is inherent in you.
Where birds never fly. Where birds never fly.
For most of his life, Bernard Punikaya lived on the island of Molokai in Hawaii. But it wasn't by choice. He was part of a community forced to live there.
People sent in exile.
Yeah.
Right, basically, yeah. Never to return. It's a very powerful place. It's a very powerful place historically, humanly, politically. It's charged.
That's Yo-Yo Ma, and I'm Ana Gonzalez. We're going to get back to Bernard in the second half of this episode. But this charge is what today's show is about. In Hawaii, they have a name for it.
That's mana right there.
Yo-Yo and I went to Molokai to tap into this mana using music, and we came away with two very different stories from two sides of this mysterious island that make us question, what do we do with all of the memories left in the land? That's today on Our Common Nature, a musical journey with Yo-Yo Ma through this complicated country to help us all find that connection to nature that so many of us are missing. In the Hawaiian archipelago, there's an island shaped like a blade, cutting the waters between Oahu and Maui.
The name of our island can be pronounced two ways, Molokai or Molokai.
Molokai, no stops, means middle of the churning oceans.
But the word kai, kai with a little glottal stop in there, kai means lead, to set the pace, to take charge. So in that sense, Molokai can also mean to produce leaders.
So I'm going to use Molokai for this episode because it makes sense, you'll see. Molokai is different than its neighbor islands, where tourists and millionaires have made and remade the landscapes. When you drive east from the airport into town on the one road that circles Molokai, there's a sign someone made that says, visit, spend, go home. As you continue to drive down that two-lane road past farms and mom-and-pop shops, sometimes the forest is so thick you can't see around the tight curves. Sometimes all you see is a cliff on one side and a drop-off into churning, foamy ocean on the other. In the rainy season, the road easily turns to mud. And the best way to get around is in a lifted Yoda, aka a raised Toyota truck. At night, Molokai is so dark, the eyes of deer and wild pigs peek out from the woods. You can feel why this island is considered, among Hawaiian people, to contain an innate power that comes from the land itself. In Hawaii, they call it mana, and it feeds everything.
Every time you eat something, you take the mana of that plant in, you drink the water, you breathe the air, you're taking all that mana, that energy, and then you convert it into the acts and words that you put out.
But you don't necessarily use all of it in your one life, especially if you've accumulated great amounts.
And then there's a bunch of it that just collects and stays with you. And that's the thing is, like, for us, mana, death cannot take away from us. It takes the body away, but the other things still exist.
Mikiala Peskaya was one of the first people Yo-Yo and I met when we landed in Molokai. She works for the U.S. Park Service and grew up in Molokai.
My first name, Mikiala, means to be alert and punctual. My grandmother gave me that name because I guess I wasn't so alert or punctual when I was younger. So it's kind of a nickname that I've kept because I think it's something worthy of aspiring to.
Mikiala loves Molokai for everything it is and everything it isn't.
We don't have any stoplights. We fish and farm. We're not very transient. Like a lot of families live in the same place or even in the same house that their parents grew up in or their grandparents built.
A lot of Mikiala's family comes from the north side of Molokai in the Pelekunu Valley, where the winds are so strong that people actually figured out a way to ride them?
Yes. Pelekunu people, they live in this narrow valley. The walls extend out into the ocean. You cannot walk the coastline. You have this narrow view. You watch the birds every day flying. You're going to notice that there are wind currents just as there are ocean currents. You'll notice the way birds glide and fly. And if you have generations and generations and generations of observation, at some point, somebody figures out, you know what? We can mimic that with a leaf. And that's what they would use to hang glide across the valley and even over the ocean.
That is the coolest thing I've heard.
Yeah.
Maybe ever. All of the elements of nature on Molokai were so strong that Mikiala was taught to name them.
Every rain has a name. Every mountain, every hill, every wind has a name. The ili'ili kihi, it'll swirl the sand at the black sand beach of Pikuone. Ku'i alalipua, it brings up the smell of the seaweed. Ku'i means to hit or strike. Ala is fragrance. Lipua is a type of seaweed. So the ku'i alalipua just knocks you out with that whiff.
Mikiala and Molokai are intertwined. And she believes, like many Molokaians do, that when she dies, she needs to be buried in Molokai so that her mana, the energy, the charge left in her physical body, can return back home.
That which is extracted from this aina should be returned to this aina.
Mikiala told me a story about someone who went to great lengths to bury his bones on Molokai and keep them secret.
Lanikaula is so powerful that his energy should not be in anyone else's hands.
In the 1500s, Lanikaula was a trusted advisor to leaders and kings because he could foresee the future. He was killed by a rival, and his family knew that when they buried him, it had to be in secret. Or else people might dig up Lanikaula's bones and use them irresponsibly, selfishly. His children decided to bury their father's body on a plateau and leave the spot unmarked. On top of his remains, they planted trees so that the mana from Lanikaula's bones would fuel the trees for eternity.
And that's why the trees are sacred, because if their roots are touching his bones, then that energy is coming up through them out into the leaves.
So Mikiala brought us to this grove, a place where the mana of Molokai's most powerful leader remains buried, so we could better understand what she's talking about.
Wow. So this area that you're looking at right here is considered the old grove.
The trees are delicate, thin trunks, and their leaves are shining and silvery. They're called kukui trees, or candle nut. I'm careful not to step on too many saplings on the ground, but they're everywhere.
Lanikaula is very peaceful. The wind moves through the trees unlike other trees. But it has this stillness when you enter it. It sort of quiets and commands reverence. It's very welcoming to sit, and yet it almost feels like you shouldn't sit and that you should be very mindful of the space you occupy when you're there.
Mikiala led us in a ceremony I couldn't record, where we sat in a small circle on a woven mat and drank ava, a drink made from a root vegetable, as we explained how we use our gifts in the world. Around our circle, there were maybe 30 more people who'd come to watch the ceremony and experience Lani Kaula with us. And then Yo-Yo took out his cello to play.
And I hope this cello works. Come closer. You can form a circle around me. This is not a stage.
He took a seat under the delicate shade of the kukui trees.
What I've learned as a musician, because, you know, I don't have a steady job, so I have to travel, play from place to place. And so I pick up things. And one thing I pick up are songs that are meaningful to people. A song that may be about a bird, but kind of a sacred bird, because for people that have experienced genocide, that becomes a symbol of life for them.
Sitting in the grove, listening to Yo-Yo play this, I felt the reverberations of his cello. I felt it before, but this time it was different. It was mixed with the energy of the people around us watching Yo-Yo play. There are beekeepers and surfers, teenagers and grandparents, aunties and uncles, all forming a circle around us. Lani Kaula's trees form a circle around them. It's a relationship of mutual protection that can only come when a community knows the history of its people and its land and recognizes the energy that still exists from those who lived here before. We had to come here first, before we could go to the other side of Molokai. We had to understand what mana is and that it could never be destroyed, even by death. Because on the north side of Molokai, there's a peninsula where death is everywhere. We go there after the break. Welcome back. This is Our Common Nature, and we're on the north side of Molokai, Hawaii, where there's a remote peninsula with a dark history.
Growing up, it was always like, oh, that's where they sent all the sick people. I never thought of it in a scary way or like an avoidance. It was more like all the sick people, that's where they took them so that nobody else got sick.
Mikiala is talking about the peninsula of Kalaupapa. It's hard to access. Folks usually fly into a small airport and then drive into town. But you could also take a mule over a mountain, hike for an hour, or historically get there by boat. Kalaupapa is a place of transition from an old Hawaii, a pre-Western, pre-US Hawaii, to a globalized, colonized Hawaii. All because of a disease that by the end of the 1800s, was ravaging the Hawaiian kingdom.
And of course, in those days, they referred to us as lepers. Yeah. And that's really a terrible word to use to describe anyone.
This is the voice of one of the more than 8,000 people sent to live in Kalaupapa because they contracted a disease that we used to call leprosy. This is one of the few voices recorded at length, and thanks to the Park Service, these VHS tapes have been digitized for us to listen to.
Well, I guess I should start off with saying my name, which is Bernard Ka'uaka'o Kalani Puni Kaio. And I've been here at Kalaupapa since 1942. So it's a long time ago.
Bernard Punikaya was interviewed in the 1980s. In these two tapes, he's sitting in a chair in his living room and on the steps of a building for staff members of Kalaupapa with palm trees in the background. At this point, he's a middle-aged man looking back on his life. But in 1942, he was 11 years old.
Okay, let's go back a little bit to some of the things at the way beginning. How old were you when you went into Kalihi?
6 and a half.
When Bernard was just 6 years old, a nurse noticed he had red spots on his neck and face, and he was sent to a local clinic.
And you stand on this little revolving stand, and everybody poke you and do things to you, just like a specimen. And finally, they told my mother that I had to be admitted to Kalihi Hospital. I didn't really understand even then that I would be taken away, you know, forever almost.
Hawaiians called the disease Ma'ihoa Ka'awale, the separating disease. Because since 1865, anyone who showed symptoms of it were separated from their families by the Hawaiian Board of Health and sent away. Because the disease spread easily, there was no treatment or cure, and a diagnosis meant first painful disfigurement and eventually death. The English speakers called it leprosy. Today, because of all the stigma associated with that term, it's called Hansen's disease. It's a bacterial infection. It attacks your skin, nerves, and respiratory tract. People lose feeling and use of their muscles until their bodies no longer function. And somehow, Bernard contracted Hansen's disease as a kid in Honolulu, and his mother was ordered to bring him to live in a nearby hospital to stop the spread.
You know, the separation, it was very difficult for my mother and myself.
There were other kids at the hospital already, different ages, and a bunch of nurses, teachers, and doctors.
And during the day, it was easy, you know, to forget. You got to go to school, you got to go to the doctors and get tests and everything. But at night, the reality sinks in, and the loneliness is really very strong. And I used to cry a lot at night.
At least his mother and siblings visited, but when they hugged, they were reprimanded by the watchful staff. Bernard made friends, and sometimes he was able to watch movies. The disease, however, progressed. It affected his face, his mouth, his hands. He figured it would just get worse in this hospital until the day he died. But then...
having our breakfast, we heard all these noises outside. Guns firing, and the radio, he was saying, this is an air raid, take cover. This is a real Makoa.
December 7th, 1941, the day the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And the hospital where Bernard was staying was just miles from the attack. So he and the other kids ran outside and climbed up a tree to see what was going on.
This plane came so low that you could see the pilot looking down like this and smiling as he was firing his gun.
With World War II on the horizon, the decision was made to move the kids away from Honolulu. And one island over, on Molokai, there was a peninsula only accessible by boat, really, because of its sharp cliffs and dense mountain forests. And people with Hansen's disease had already been sent there for the past 80 years.
The chief said to us that we're sending you to Kalaupapa. The nurses had helped to make us very much afraid. The description they do, you know, give to us, you know, scared the hell out of you. and you're talking about blood all over the walls and everything. And we were just kids, and everyone across said, please, 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 don't send us.
Already, Kalaupapa had a reputation among Hawaiians. It was known as the place where people with Hansen's disease went to die.
You have these tall cliffs that sort of the island broke and sheared off, and it created all these big boulders in the ocean. The water is rough and deep, and it's always, like, moving.
Kalaupapa sits just to the west of where Mikiala's families would hang glide over the winds and sea. And it's a similar geography. You have these 2,000-foot sea cliffs that form a natural barrier around a valley by the sea. So King Kamehameha V chose Kalaupapa as the site of Hawaii's official quarantine for people with Hansen's disease. Patients began arriving on ships in 1866.
It was really harsh in the early years.
Today, Kalaupapa is a national historical park, and part of Mikiala's job is to help people understand the colony's history.
There were some people who felt like I died the day I left home.
Because for Hawaiian people, especially at that time, the land was family. Removing someone from their homelands was a spiritual death. Not everybody sent to Kalaupapa was Hawaiian. You had people from Europe and Asia there as well. But the stigma against contracting this disease was so high, it crossed all cultures. Some families disowned their sick relatives. Married couples often divorced. Mothers had to leave their children. And they all had to start a new life in a series of small wooden houses in the valley between cliffs where the wind whipped. The colony wasn't prepared for the hundreds of patients they received. People didn't live very long once they arrived. But over time, the community became stronger. The doctors and nurses became more informed, the church leaders had more compassion, and people with the disease began advocating for themselves. And by 1942, when 11-year-old Bernard and the rest of the kids from Kalihi Hospital set sail for their new home, the scary stories of Kalaupapa were a thing of the past.
As we were coming in, we looked, you know, to a shore, and we could see the people just lined up, you know, from the shop area all the way down to the camp. People just lined, hundreds of people.
All the hundreds of residents of Kalaupapa came to greet this new shipment of kids, and they immediately welcomed them into their world. Instead of blood on the walls and scary sick people, Bernard found beaches, birds, monk seals, lava rocks. He found other kids to play with, and aunties and uncles who invited him over for dinner in their homes.
It was really great, this Kalaupapa patients. You know, when they came down with their fish and dried fish and pipi kaula and pihis, poi, and would just dig in, you know, as you say today, dig out, you know, that good Hawaiian food.
Even better, there were parties.
You know, they always had an excuse for a celebration. And there were at least three patient orchestras that would rotate during the dancing hour. And everybody danced, they had the entire floor to the patients.
Bernard started going to church. He became a Catholic. Even though the disease had affected his face and hands, Bernard felt comfortable enough to begin to sing and accompany himself on the auto harp. Compared to the hospital in Honolulu, living in Kalaupapa felt free. But there were still restrictions. Kalaupapa was run by the Hawaiian Board of Health. Patients could not leave and travel to other islands. They had jobs and chores, and they still had Hansen's disease.
I was in the hospital for a long period of time. The doctor had looked down my throat and said that it was so bad that sooner or later they would have to do a tracheotomy. That was a reality.
Bernard's condition got so bad, doctors considered cutting a hole in his throat and placing in breathing and feeding tubes if the disease progressed. But at this point, there were treatments for Hansen's disease being used in other places, just not at Kalapapa. And they were working.
The success rate was so great. And yet, our physicians here refused to even consider it. Their rationale was that it was still experimental and there was no guarantees. And people were not asking for guarantee. Without a medication, the guarantee was you would die. That's it, plain and simple.
So the patients of Kalaupapa came together and demanded to get this new treatment or take the administration at Kalaupapa to court. The pressure worked. The drugs came.
They were the miracle drugs. They changed our lives. They really did.
Bernard started to heal. More on that story after the break. Our Common Nature is back. Bernard Punikaya had been at Kalaupapa for more than 20 years before the drugs to treat Hansen's disease arrived. And that's also around the time that Anhui Skinsis Law first went to the north side of Molokai.
I started going to Kalaupapa when I was 16. I'm now getting Social Security, so it's been a lifetime.
It was the 1960s, and the patients at Kalaupapa were still legally forced to spend their lives on this peninsula with jagged cliffs and whipping winds. But the disease was no longer a death sentence.
Kalaupapa was a very lively place in those days. And there was a gathering place called Mariano's Bar, which is where everybody, you could go meet people. And you'd be in there and everyone would buy you beer and you'd leave with a pile of six packs there. And Mariano, the owner, would save them for next time. I'm sure that is where I met Bernard. And I can't even remember what year it was.
Bernard was a people person. He was always out at the parties and functions of Kalaupapa, singing and playing music.
There was one they always called, the alphabet song. It was called Kalaupapa, and it was like K-A-L-A-U-P-A-P-A, and it was like he would say, Kalaupapa, my hometown.
At first, Bernard was skeptical of this white teenage girl. A lot of the residents were.
But I kept coming back, and the question always started being, are you spending the night here? Because if you spent a night, it showed you had more commitment than if you just flew in and out.
And eventually, Anhui got a grant to start recording oral histories of the residents of Kalaupapa.
I mean, you know, you naturally go and you talk about when someone was taken away from their family and the pain and the separation, but we also made a point of talking and recording people's talents. You know, if they were painters or musicians and things like that.
She recorded people playing ukulele, reading poetry, and telling their life stories. And eventually, Anhui convinced Bernard to sit for two on-camera interviews. That's what you've been listening to this whole time.
So, do you have any other questions?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Now I'll start. Okay, let's go back a little bit to some of the things at the way beginning. How old were you when you went?
A lot of their conversations had to do with Bernard's work in local politics and advocating for the residents of Kalaupapa.
So Bernard was on the Citizens Committee that studied the laws and, you know, they were still fumigating mail. They were doing all these outdated things.
Kalaupapa at this point was a medical colony that was over 100 years old. There were no new residents because the drugs were preventing outbreaks of Hansen's disease elsewhere. And yet the laws keeping people in Kalaupapa had not changed since the 1860s.
It was about 104 years we had of isolation. To realize that our laws were so archaic and so from medieval times almost, even though there were no longer any valid medical reasons to maintain an isolation policy, and yet they still adhere to that.
So Bernard worked with other residents and patients to repeal the law. In 1969, the government of Hawaii repealed the law. Bernard was 39 years old. For the first time since he was 6 years old, he could travel wherever he wanted. And one of the first places he went was his first home, Honolulu.
And after more than 20 years away, during which time there was World War II and Hawaii became a U.S. state, the world had changed.
Got up this morning and looked around me. Do you see the beauty of my Hawaii? Took a little walk into the town. Pain and sorrow are the things I found. Walls of concrete reaching to the sky, higher and higher.
Bernard began living in Honolulu in a residential treatment facility for people with Hansen's disease. It was called Hale Mohalu. And there's this famous moment where the government tried to knock that building down. And Bernard is photographed getting arrested and dragged out of the apartment with other protesters.
We dared to challenge the state and say, no, we won't go, we will not go. You know, Hale Mohalu is our home. You may not do with us as you have been doing for the last 100+ years. Try to find my way to the sea. Blocks of concrete were hiding it from me. Turned right around to see the mountain. Towers of concrete had done it again.
The song you're hearing right now is the only recording I could find of Bernard singing and playing auto harp. He's playing with guitarist Peter Kealoha and another auto harpist named Imai Kalani Kalahele. It's a song he wrote reflecting on his own history and the history of Hawaii. It's called Where Birds Never Fly.
Oh my gosh.
I played it for Yo-Yo.
Where birds never fly.
It's a mournful song, but I also see a lot of joy in just the fact that he's playing it. He wrote it. He was supposed to be gone. Right. He was supposed to be dead to his family at age 11.
Yeah. He says, okay, look, you know, what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell a story. You can see it on video that I've had Hansen's disease. Mm-hmm. I'm singing about this whole history, and he's like a bard. I'm now going to tell you the story of my life. This is what's happened over decades, and you're left to live with it.
Yeah.
Shostakovich wrote about the Stalin era in a way that is not about saying, okay, here millions of people died, because I don't have capacity to understand what millions of people means.
Right. Just like 8,000 people sent for having Hansen's disease, like exiles. Like, that's too much for you to understand, comprehend.
How many families? Look, I mean, let me give you the encyclopedia of all the names of the families. Okay, what am I going to do about it?
Right.
But you hear a song like that, I can hear it over and over again, and I could pass it on to you, and you could live with it.
So I asked Yo-Yo if he would learn the song and play it with Bernard. So,
does it make sense, what I wrote? Okay, good.
I'm going to turn it a little louder so you can hear it better.
Yep. And I'll play just very quietly so that it just kind of matches.
Cool. All right, here we go.
Walls of concrete reaching to the sky, higher and higher.
That's great. That's great. That is great.
Bernard lived the remaining years of his life traveling the world to promote the dignity and rights of people with Hansen's disease. When he was back in Hawaii, he split his time between Honolulu and Kalaupapa, where a lot of his old friends still lived in their seaside homes.
I lived in West Virginia by that time, and he would call me up and we would
you know, sometimes work on things. And that's why one day he called me and he said, I know you're going to think this is weird, but will you give the eulogy at my funeral? So I said, yeah.
And then when did that day come that you had to go?
He died in 2009, February 25th, 2009.
Bernard had two services, one in Honolulu and one in Kalaupapa. His body was buried in Kalaupapa in a cemetery called Papaloa.
This is Papaloa.
The sister was saying like 2,000 people are buried.
Yes, this is the mass graves right here.
In Kalaupapa today, there are more graves than there are people. Some are in mass graves, and others are individual markers that shine bright under the hot sun. Some are ornate, others are small and worn. Some are just crosses in sandy grass. And many have washed away entirely due to tidal waves and erosion.
How's that? Is that safe? Is that okay?
Nice.
Okay.
Bernard is buried here, along with hundreds of other people who called Kalaupapa home. Yo-Yo is here to play for all those who have died, and for the very few who remain living here.
I'm so grateful to be able to hear, and I thank you for allowing our presence, my presence, to be here to honor and to pay respects for all the people that have been part of this community.
Yo-Yo settles into his chair and unscrews the end pin of his cello as he squints the sun out of his eyes.
And I want to thank especially Uncle Danny for being here. I was told, Danny, you've been here since 1942. So that's about 80 years, if my math is still working.
Yo-Yo is talking to a man in a wheelchair, flanked by nurses. He's older, and I'm standing behind him, so I can't see his face, but I know he's a patient. He came with Bernard, actually, on that ship in 1942, and he's still here. Soon, a rusty old pickup truck pulls up right next to him, and it's another man, another patient. Out of the 8,000 people who were forced to come to Kalaupapa, these two men are the sole survivors.
The history of Kalaupapa is not over, but now is a challenge. How do you do justice to everything?
There are plans to create a memorial to the patients of Kalaupapa within Kalaupapa National Historical Park, where all of their names would be engraved on a stone wall. But Mikiala, our friend from the top of the show who took us to Lanikaula and works at Kalaupapa, says not everybody agrees with that decision.
So for me, it's rough because I work for the Park Service, we have to remain neutral. Professionally, I have to remain neutral. But as a descendant of a patient, I get to say that personally, like, no, we don't want his name on that.
This is the first time that Mikiala admitted to me, after knowing her and speaking with her for hours, that she had a relative who was a patient at Kalaupapa. She won't say who, but I can tell that the admission comes with a lot of baggage. And so she says that there's a much simpler, much more discreet and personal way to memorialize the people who came to Kalaupapa.
If we know stories like, they used to come to this beach and go fishing all the time, go and stand in the water there and have a moment and say your prayers.
How do you connect with your ancestor who is a patient?
We chant, we sing to them, we dance. I just talk to them all the time. I feel like they're always here. They like it here. And I think they like me being here because every time I try to leave, they find some reason to remove my other opportunities.
They're going to miss you. You can't leave them.
Yes, that's how I feel.
In life, the thousands of people forced to Kalaupapa had so many of their freedoms taken from them and so much of their identity. But in death, their energy, their mana, what made them who they are, remains here, in the land.
One of the things that I've been learning in Molokai is that energy is key to life. And one of the things I learned from science is energy is never destroyed. So if this were true, it means that the energy of our ancestors, of all the people who've traveled, come here, is not gone. So here's a way to call them through music.
Do you hear that bird? If you've listened to enough of this show, you know that I'm going to say that's got to be Bernard. And maybe some of the other 8,000 people who came to Kalaupapa are here too. And as I stand here listening to Yo-Yo, I hear the ocean, I hear the wind. I hear the people who gave their mana back to this land that are still here. And I'm connected to them.
When you're here, that peace that you feel, that's them.
What an honor it's been. Thank you very much.
Thank
Danny,
you.
Thank you. May I shake your hand?
Yeah.
May I shake your hand? Thank you, sir. I hope it pleased you a little bit.
It did.
Okay. Good. That's what the music is there for. Keep now. Okay?
All right.
All right. Thank you very much.
In the next episode of Our Common Nature, we stay in Hawaii, and we go a little bit deeper into how music and chanting can connect us to the deepest parts of our existence.
I just have a whale of a time.
And it's the finale, so it's gonna be a good one. Hope you listen. Our Common Nature is a production of WNYC and Sound Postings, hosted by me, Anna Gonzalez, produced by Alan Gofinski, with editing from Pearl Marvel. Sound design and episode music by Alan Gofinski, mixed by Joe Plord, fact-checking by Anna Alvarado. Our executive producers are Emily Botine, Ben Mandelkern, Sophie Shackleton, and Jonathan Bays. Our advisors are Mira Bertwin-Tonic, Kamaka Diaz, Kelly Libby, and Chris Newell. Special thanks to Kalaupapa National Historical Park, Mikiala and Kaoki Peskaya, Val Lawson of Ka'ohana o Kalaupapa, Uncle Bobby and Patty, and Anwe Skinsis Law. And also to Joan Lander of Namaka o Ka'aina for her recording of Where Birds Never Fly. If you want to watch the video of Bernard playing it, it's in our show notes. And if you want to listen to more music from this series, you can check out the Our Common Nature EP, featuring Yo-Yo playing with Eric Mingus, Jen Kreisberg, and an Icelandic choir, now available on all streaming platforms. This podcast was inspired by a project of the same name conceived by Yo-Yo Ma and Sound Postings with creative direction by Sophie Shackleton in collaboration with partners all over the world. Our Common Nature is made possible with support from Emerson Collective and Tambourine Philanthropies. See you next time.